This podcast contains descriptions of graphic violence. It is not appropriate for children.
The psych that I saw, I still see her every now and then, but she described PTSD as like a bottle. And when I started policing, my bottle was pretty much empty. Every job I went to that had an effect on me was represented by a drip of water in that bottle. And what happened with all these jobs that I'd done, it was really just the bottle was slowly filling. And when I did that job with the child porn, that's when my bottle overflowed. Hence, the bottle couldn't take any more water.
That's former Homicide Squad member Narelle Fraser from a previous episode of Australian True Crime, in which she discussed her policing career and the reason it ended abruptly. PTSD. Undoubtedly one of the biggest cases in Narelle's career was that of Melbourne mother Maria Corp, who disappeared from her suburban home in February 2005. It didn't take long for rumours of marriage infidelity and adult websites to appear in the media, and in time, a sad and complicated story would unfold. This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the headlines to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next. In this episode, we find out how Maria Corp changed Narelle Fraser's life forever.
I was at Missing Persons Unit, and with Missing Persons, we monitor all reported missing persons in the state. And this was another one that came up, and just in your gut feeling is that there's something different about this one than the other, I don't know, 6,000 or 8,000 that go missing each year.
Now, her brother-in-law reported her missing, didn't he?
No, it was actually Joe.
Her husband?
Mm.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So Joe reported her missing the night that she didn't come home.
Okay.
So I suppose we start at the end and then we go back.
Mm-hmm.
But we got the call, we got the notification 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Joe had gone into the Craigieburn police station to say that his wife hadn't picked up their son from school. And also she hadn't been to work during that day. And so that was Joe was her husband and he was reporting her missing. Now, again, I don't know what it was, gut feeling, whatever, but something wasn't right. It was so out of the, like they were just an ordinary couple. Mm-hmm. There was nothing known about them. So we get the job and we go down to Craigieburn that night and we get a statement from Joe about what has happened. And all he can tell us is that he'd left her that morning, he'd kissed her goodbye on his way to work, and he hadn't spoken to her during the day and she hadn't turned up, hence why he's gone to the police.
So he's got no theories. He's not one of these guys who says she was having an affair or she's left me or we had a fight about money and she went for a walk to clear her head or any of those stories we hear.
Yeah.
He had nothing.
I don't believe so. Mm. And if it was something, it was very minor.
Mm-hmm.
So we get a statement from him to get all the information we can. They lived in a very Italian, well, what would you call it? Lots of marble and lots of staircases. Mm. And it was quite an elaborate sort of house in Craigieburn, and we went out to the house and we had a bit of a look around. We spoke to the kid. There was a little boy, Damien, and Maria's daughter, Laura. We spoke to them and there was nothing out of the ordinary. But what was missing was her car. We couldn't find her car. So I think it was for the following morning, I think we found out through through emails that Joe had befriended a woman by the name of Tanya Herman on the emails. And as we pressed Joe a bit, he told us that they'd met online, on a chat room or something, and that she was like just a friend. Well, we looked into that a bit and we found out that it was actually a threesome site. And him and Maria had been on a threesome site looking for
a third.
Mm. So, and Tanya was on a site as well looking for a couple. Mm. So that's, he hadn't told us that, which was a little bit unusual.
Yeah.
But then again, I understand his hesitancy because I don't suppose that's something, oh, by the way, you know, I have threesomes. It's not something that you would willingly give, I suppose. Mm. But it was just a little bit of an inkling that he wasn't being totally honest. And the more we looked, we went around and saw Tanya the following morning, and Tanya seemed reasonably upfront that they'd met on a threesome and they'd had a couple of, I don't know what you
encounters.
Meetings.
Encounters.
Yes. This was at a house in Greenvale where we spoke to Tanya. And as things progressed during the day, we found out that Joe was actually paying Tanya's rent in Greenvale. And for somebody that wasn't all that, you know, Joe was very sort of flippant about Tanya, but he was actually paying for her rent, and she told us that they'd met and that he'd, you know, said he was going to marry her.
Wow.
And all this sort of stuff.
He's paying her rent, so that's, yep, substantially more than, yes, a relationship that's about encounters,
yes, yeah,
on the internet.
And to be honest, for no other reason, I don't remember a lot about the build-up to this job other than what I'm going to tell you, which is find Maria in the boot, because that, for whatever reason, that takes over nearly everything that I did with this job. Mm. But I do know that after about the second day, Joe was in our sights. We knew that something wasn't quite right, and their stories didn't gel. And I think we had LDs, listening devices, put in the houses, and we found that Tanya and Joe were talking about, like, don't tell them that I met you here, and it was stuff that wasn't quite right. In the end, we look three or four days, and then we think we need to do a meet. We need to find the car. We need to find Maria. So we do a media release and say, this is her car. If anybody sees it, we need to find it. And I think almost that night or the next day, it was a Sunday morning, and I'm working with a colleague of mine. We're at work, and it's early, like maybe 9:15 or something. And a phone call came into the office, and it was from a shrine guard that had found the car.
The Shrine of Remembrance,
yes,
in Melbourne.
Yep.
Yeah.
And he was at the car, and it was in just off Domain Road.
Uh-huh.
We could have seen the car from virtually where our offices,
yeah,
were in St Kilda Road. So my colleague and I, we raced down there, and we'd rung a sergeant to say they found the car. So things behind the scenes, lots of, you know, they were getting people from everywhere. And so my colleague and I went down there anyway. The car was there, and there was condensation all in the inside of the car, and we didn't want to touch the car because we were thinking of evidence and all that sort of stuff. And Maria wasn't, we couldn't see Maria.
Mm-hmm.
So we deduced that she was probably in the boot.
Oh, really? You did think that?
Well, yes.
Oh, okay.
Because of the condensation, something was making the car from the inside.
Right.
It was it was condensation, but also it was a pretty bad smell.
Oh.
When you got reasonably close to it, there's a really bad smell. Mm. So the sergeant arrives, and we made a decision that was very – it's a big decision to make. Maria is probably in the back, but if we get in the back and we get into the boot and damage,
disturb
the crime scene. However, human life will always take precedence, but we didn't know what to do. So we rang the guys, some special guys that can get into anything, police, and we rang them and said, how far off are you? We think she's in the boot. And they said we could probably be there in about 15 minutes. So we made a decision to wait. It was the hot February sun and she'd been there 4 days. It was an awful decision. I remember thinking, God, I hope she's not alive in there. But really, with the hot February sun, the car had been missing for 4 days. So we just sort of, it was just a decision that was made. So when the guys got there and opened up the boot, when they actually opened it, the smell initially, there was probably about 15 detectives around the back of the boot, including me, around the back of the boot. And when they opened it, they did a really good job. Like, they hardly made a mark or hardly touched it. And when they opened it, the smell was, it would knock you over. So when they opened the boot and there was that terrible smell, we saw her there. And she was sort of lying, like in a fetal position, but I couldn't get over, like she was decomposing.
I didn't know that was possible if you weren't dead.
No, well, so I saw, because I was right at the boot, we thought she was dead because she wasn't moving and she was in the fetal position.
She's decomposing.
Yeah, absolutely. And the smell. I mean, unfortunately, when you have dealt with dead bodies, there's a particular smell, and that was the smell. Uh-huh. It's a smell you never forget. Mm. And so somebody, the sergeant probably said, somebody's going to have to get in there. And I said I would. Just looking at her, being so alone, she was so helpless. It was awful. I just wanted to get in there. And I just wanted to hug her or hold her or just do something. So I said, I'll get in. So I got in, and although we wanted to check that, to make sure that she was deceased, I also was very aware of contaminating the crime scene. So I got in and I sort of laid next to her, a little bit like a spoon. Mm-hmm. And I checked all the signs of life that I could, but it was horrific because she was decomposing, and she was decomposing through her nose, through her ears, through her bottom, through her eyes. Oh, she was a terrible mess. But I just put that all aside. So I laid next to her and I checked everything, and I couldn't find any signs of life. And I said to the sergeant, she's dead. And everyone, we thought that. And then just on a whim, I thought I might just put my head on her chest and just make 110% sure. So I manoeuvred myself and I put my head on her chest. And I'll never forget, I sort of felt her chest very, very slowly move up and down. And it was like... And I yelled, she's alive, she's alive, quick. So everyone rallied around into action. We got an ambo. It was a whole lot of things, shocking. So the ambos come and they very carefully put her onto the trolley. And I remember... I didn't want to leave her, and I remember telling her, like holding her hand and just sort of stroking her hand. And I can remember saying, I don't remember what I said, but it was just comforting her, I mm-hmm. suppose. And I really didn't want to leave her. Anyway, when the ambos came and put her in the back, I went with her because we thought that she might make what's called a dying declaration, like, she may miraculously wake up and say it was Joe or it was Doug or whoever.
Yeah.
So I had my notebook ready in case she said something, and I stayed with her. Anyway, we had to stop on the railway, on the tram tracks going down St Kilda Road. We were going to the Alfred, and we had to stop on the tram tracks because I remember they were trying to get all these lines in her to, because they said that she, they didn't think she would last till the Alfred, like they thought she would pass away. Mm. And so they're trying to put lines in, I think, her nose, her feet. I'm sure they tried to put a, something in her foot just to try and get her going again. Mm-hmm. And I think she died on the, track, and then they got her going again. And this is all with me there. And then we get into the hospital, and I'll never forget when we arrived at the hospital, they got a spray can, and everywhere we went, they sprayed.
After you.
Yeah. Anyway, mm-hmm. they rushed her into an operating theatre, and the sergeant said to me, "Don't leave her," mm-hmm. because, and also evidence-wise, like to make sure that everything was above board, and if she said something. So I went. I was with her, and we rushed into the operating theatre, and then they just ripped everything off, and they put things to try and because they couldn't find a heart rate and all this sort of stuff. Anyway, and there was somebody walking around with this spray thing, and I just thought, oh, you know, I just felt it was a little bit undignified.
Undignified.
Yeah. Mm. I thought, come on, you know. Anyway, I eventually left because they did some operation, but I left and they gave me her clothes and all that for evidence. And we then, that was sort of the when we found her in the boot, but she never regained consciousness. She died 6 months later.
Coming up on Australian True Crime, the story of Maria Korp's controversial final days. A relative allegedly seeks to profit from her situation, and a man she's never met decides if she'll live or die. Maria Korp, found by police in the boot of her car, 4 days after she'd been reported missing by her husband Joe, never regained consciousness. But her body continued to deteriorate in her hospital bed. Eventually, after several months, a social worker at the hospital applied to the Victorian Civil and Administrative Tribunal, or VCAT, to establish who should make medical decisions for and about Maria. VCAT chose not to appoint anyone from Maria's family, but instead the public advocate for the state of Victoria, Julian Gardner, became Maria's court-appointed guardian. In July of 2005, 6 months after she was strangled and left for dead, Gardner made the decision to withdraw Maria's life support and allow her to die. It was a controversial decision, to say the least, and it was not supported by Maria's family. While that drama was playing out, police were quietly working at trying to find out exactly what happened to Maria and why.
In that 6 months, Tanya became a prosecution witness. She actually decided to tell us all with what had happened with her and
Joe.
Wow. And her and Joe had decided that the only way that they were going to be able to be together was for Maria to be killed. Mm. So they both, Joe was certainly the instigator, mm-hmm. and they decided that they were going to kill her by, with the strangling her, and it was going to be in the car when she was leaving to go to work one morning. So Joe got all the gear. This is what Tanya told us. Joe got all the gear together. I think she had a hood and she a strap to strangle Maria.
Just like in the movies.
Yep, yeah.
Yep.
So what they've decided is Maria, this particular morning, she led a very regimented life, got the kids breakfast and all that sort of stuff, got their lunch, and she's going down to the she parked underneath the house. Mm. And it was very dark, and Joe had driven to Greenvale to get Tanya. This is at like 5 o'clock in the morning. She was in place so that when Maria came down, she was in the back of the car, and she was going to strangle Maria. Anyway, basically that's what happened. There was a bit of a struggle. Maria actually struggled more than Tanya would thought.
But Maria was tiny too, wasn't she?
Oh, yeah.
So I think they relied upon her. that.
Yeah, yeah. And Tanya was a triathlete.
Wow.
Tanya was quite a tall girl, really well built. She had a really good body, like strong. And so when she strangled her, she managed to get her into the boot, or she thought she'd killed her, and she put her into the boot. And then she sort of panicked. She didn't know what to do, and she drove to the shrine and just left her there. Mm. And she rang Joe, what am I going to do with the keys? So they sorted out what they were going to do. And Tanya went to her brother's work, and basically she told her brother what she'd done.
Wow. Oh. Immediately.
Pretty much, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But, of course, she swore him to secrecy. Mm. And, of course, then it was just not trying to break Tanya down, but trying to get her. We sort of knew by this stage. Oh, and she had, that's what I forgot to say, in the back of the car, I could tell she had, she'd been strangled because she had these bruising and blood and all that around her neck. So we knew she'd been strangled. Mm. Eventually, Tanya came over to the prosecution side, but
why did she do that? Was she offered some kind of deal in terms of her own case to do that?
No. What Tanya actually was, again, from a really good family, and she had no previous issues with police, a really good person, but she was very, very unlucky in love. She'd had her, I think she'd been married twice, but one of her last husband had died only a month before she met Joe, I think.
Wow.
But that was, he was on a riverboat somewhere in Echuca, and he'd passed away, I believe natural causes, but he was only like 45 or something. And but she just was looking for love. That was her crime.
What was it about Joe? Like, what is Joe like?
Oh, my, I have no idea. Oh, to be honest, I thought, what?
Yeah.
He was sleazy. Mm. He was one of those blokes that, you know, wears the big gold chains and the hairy chest and just walks around like he's Superman.
Strutting. Those men who strut.
Yes. So, but Tanya, all she wanted was just love. That's all she was looking for. And she was besotted with Joe.
I was thinking she must have been obsessed by him.
She was. And she admits that.
To do that.
Yeah, she admits that. He actually said to her, you know, I can't get married until we get rid of Maria. We'll get married. We'll have a son. Like, they actually spoke about, he told her what she wanted to hear.
Yeah. Mm.
And she was actually so desperate, obsessed with him, that she would actually murder for him.
Mm.
Like, you just, yeah. But Joe, he ended up committing suicide. Did I say that?
No, you didn't say that. But
I have a vague recollection.
The day that
they were charged, him and Tanya were eventually charged with attempted murder, because Maria was in a coma for 6 months, so they couldn't charge her with murder. But they were charged with attempted murder, and that's when Tanya became a prosecution witness. But Joe was adamant he was going to,
fight the charges.
Fight the charges. So when Maria actually, there was a lot of dramas, and I don't remember it.
Are you talking about the drama around the sort of removing the feeding tube for Maria and stuff like that?
Oh, yeah, I remember reading about that.
So that became very controversial because
they ended up having to get a public advocate for Maria.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe had taken some money out of Maria and Joe's account, so Laura, the daughter, had to apply to have the funds frozen. But because Maria was still alive as such, there was all sorts of dramas in the Supreme Court about representing Maria. And
then euthanasia advocates became and opposition became involved. Yeah. It became a political kind of case.
Yeah.
But in the end, she did pass away.
Yes, and so apparently Joe wanted to say goodbye. and they allowed him, I think, to say goodbye, but he was flanked by detectives or something, I think. But he said goodbye and he came out and he went home. And when Maria was, her funeral was a couple of days later, and on the day of her funeral he committed suicide. He hung himself. And so, you know, Joe left a lovely little boy. Well, he wouldn't be a little boy now, but he was a beautiful boy, Damien.
Parentless.
He was only about 8, 9.
Oh, my God.
That's just shocking.
Yeah. So he's lost his mum and his dad. Yeah. But Laura was, she was under enormous pressure, but she was a beautiful
she was older,
sister.
Wasn't she?
Oh, yeah, a lot older. Mm. Laura was about 24, something like that. But
and Joe was her stepdad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So whatever happened to Tanya Herman? Did she do time?
Yeah, she did. She did 10 years and she's out now.
10 years is a fair whack, isn't
it? Oh, yeah. Look, that's true. I think a lot of people would say she deserves And I understand that, but I don't know whoever's been to a jail before, but one day in there would do my head in.
Mm.
10 years is a long time. I heard all sorts of stories that Tanya had fallen in love with another woman in there and that they were going to get married. I don't know what's happened since. But I can always remember there were photos on the – Maria never wanted to, according to her family, and I tend to believe that, that Maria loved Joe. She had no idea that there was anything wrong, and Joe wanted to spice up their sex life. And she made the worst decision she could ever make because Joe said, I want to go on a website and I want a threesome. And apparently that was just not Maria. But they said Maria would do anything to keep the marriage alive.
And the photos surfaced, I remember, the famous photo of Maria in a boob tube that was used on the website. So it sort of made Maria look sleazy too. Yeah.
Well, apparently it got to the point where Maria tried to emulate Tanya. Maria was trying to win Joe back.
Yeah.
And it was just so like poor Maria. She was doing everything because she did the terrible crime of loving a man. You know, she just wanted to keep him happy. And she even went, and that was the worst thing she ever did because Joe and Tanya fell in lust, in love, whatever you want to call it. I have no doubt. This is going to sound wrong, but Tanya was actually a really, I really liked Tanya. I went out and saw her a number of times out at Dame Phyllis Frost.
Yeah.
We got on particularly well, and she wanted to see me just about a few things that were going on out there, and I don't know if she wanted some more food or not food, just a couple of things, and she wanted to tell us a couple of other things that she'd remembered. But her crime initially before murder was that she was just looking for love. That's all she was looking for. But
what an interesting person Joe must have been. What sort of charisma did he have to have these two women orbiting him like satellites trying to win his love? And
well, apparently he was he was a real ladies' man. He had been married to what was the woman's name? He'd had two kids to a woman. He was in the army or a Pakapunyal or something, and he actually left her. He had an affair with Maria. And that's how him and Maria got together. Because I think Maria's husband might have died and she was on her own. But Joe was very, very popular with the ladies. And even though he repulsed me, his sort of style, you know, some people like that.
But I was shocked that he committed suicide. I didn't see that coming. I had an image of him as a certain kind of arrogant man, and I was shocked that he took his own life. Did you find that shocking?
Not really.
Okay.
No, I don't know why. I wasn't surprised at all. He was under – it was funny, like he – I think he actually really – I don't know about loved Tanya – but I think he found it all very exciting. It was an affair and he was keeping her secret, and it was a bit of a fairy tale almost, if that's
– yeah. Mm.
And I think he was torn. I think he actually did love Maria in a funny way, but he also felt, well, initially with Tanya, but...
But he did feel the gravity of Maria's death.
Yeah, he did. And I always remember there was something wrong with Joe, clearly. Well, clearly. But when we did a warrant on his house, there was an office. He had an office. I'm not sure why, because he worked at Dunlop Tires or something out in Craigieburn. And why he had an office, I'm not too sure. But that office had everything an office would have plus more. He had hundreds of pens. He had hundreds, like, say, 20 staplers. He had reams and reams of paper and everything that you would want in an office. And it was clear that he never used it. And he'd pinched them from Dunlop where he worked.
Oh.
So he was a bit of a kleptomaniac.
A klepto.
Yeah. Oh, it was very strange. The whole office thing. And also Maria, we found out later that Maria had actually spoken to a girlfriend. She must have known something. Maria would see clairvoyance, and she was trying to keep the marriage, it back on track or whatever.
Yeah.
And she told a girlfriend, if ever anything happens to me, and she gave her girlfriend something. She was very religious, and she gave her girlfriend something. So she actually felt that her life was in danger. Oh, there were intervention orders taken out. She took out an intervention order when Joe and Tanya, when she found out about them.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. There was a lot. And that's what I mean. It's a bit all over the place, but there was lots and lots of issues going on.
But she was fighting for her marriage. She was trying to get Joe back.
And then she got a bit scared of Joe, so she took out the intervention order. And the intervention order was lifted the day before she was killed.
Oh, poor Maria.
I know, and it's like you fall in love with someone for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And he sounds like an absolute sleaze bag, but you know, those kind of men say the things that women who want
to
hear.
Joe knew what to say.
Vulnerable women. Yeah. They know exactly what to say.
That's a very good point. That's exactly what Tanya was.
Yeah.
That's the word. Tanya was very vulnerable. And maybe Maria was too when Maria's marriage broke down. But I remember another thing. You know how we were talking about all the stuff that was going on behind the scenes with all the court stuff, the intervention orders, the public advocate, another one which I just could not get my head around and I still can't, the cruelty, was Joe's brother Gus.
Mm.
He went into the hospital and took a photo of Maria in a coma and gave it to Channel and some other stuff. And
would have got paid for it.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
And Laura had to go to court to stop them publishing it. Why would anybody want to take a photo or want to see a photo of this poor woman in a coma?
And also the TV stations publishing that. I think there's just a level of public decorum.
Where is that? Like, you know, that line, surely that's been crossed.
Mm.
That's shocking. Poor Laura. Do you know what happened to Laura? Like,
no, but she was like, what a responsibility. Like, she was only 24, I think. So she had little Damien to look after. Yeah.
Her mum's hasn't just died, has died in an extremely violent, distressing way.
And just one other thing, a little story that is one of my favourite stories. It's one of the most beautiful stories. Is about Maria Korp, is that during my recovery from being diagnosed with PTSD, I went to the Austin Hospital. The police put me through a PTSD program, and it was for 10 weeks and for 2 days for 10 weeks. And I used to stay down in Melbourne at a hotel that the police put me up in. So one particular night, I was down there for 1 night and 2 days, right? Mm-hmm. So I used to go and want to... just touch base with reality, like I was saying last week. I just wanted to see someone normal and see a girlfriend and have a bite to eat and whatever.
Yeah.
So this particular night we're in Northcote. We're in this little Vietnamese restaurant. There are about 100 people per square inch. You know what they're like, you know, and there's yelling and there's number 67 takeaway. Everyone's yelling and rushing. And anyway, we sit down in this restaurant, girlfriend and I, and it's really loud and lots of people. And in walks this guy And I recognised him as being a policeman, but I couldn't remember where from, but it was an acknowledgement. So he sort of, you know, hi. And so I go, hi. And he goes and sits down with his wife. He's coming with a female. I imagine it's his wife. So he goes in and sits down. So Trace and I are having our meal and we're having a drink, and 10 minutes goes by. And the guy comes up and he comes and kisses me on the cheek and he says, thank you. And before I have time to say thank you for thanking me, but what are you thanking me for, He goes and goes back to his seat. And there wasn't any sort of time to ask anything. So, oh, thanks very much. Anyway, so another hour goes by and he's leaving and he comes up and he kisses me on the cheek again. He comes and he kisses me again. And he said, I meant what I said before. Thank you so much. I will never forget what you did. And he said, I was at the back of the boot with Maria Korp. And he said, I will never forget seeing you in the boot with her. And he said, you stroked her hand. And he said, I'll never forget you saying to her, you're safe now, Maria. Nobody will ever hurt you again. I will stay with you. By this stage, he's crying in the Vietnamese restaurant. So am I. His wife's crying. My girlfriend's crying. It was an unbelievable couple of minutes. So after we sort of, you know, hugged each other and all that, and he said to me, so what are you doing now, Narelle? And I said, you're not going to believe this, but I'm actually at a PTSD course. And he put his head in his hands and he started to really get so upset. And I said, it's okay. You don't actually understand what you've done. You've actually given me something nice to think about with Maria, whereas all I could think about was her decomposing. And I said, so what about you? What are you doing? And he said, I never, ever went back. That job did me in.
Wow.
He said, I never went back. And so he has suffered in silence. Mm-hmm. He has never said to anyone why he left. He just collected his things, never came back in. And that's what I think is so sad about policing, is that there are so many police out there that he was ashamed of him not being him being so affected by me in the boot. Mm-hmm. It was just his bottle filled up that day.
Yeah.
And I think how many other police out there are silently suffering.
Thank you for downloading Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. If you'd like to hear more from Narelle Fraser, you can go back and listen to our earlier episode, and you can also book her for speaking engagements at narellefraser.com. We'll pop that link on our Facebook page. If you'd like to help more people find this podcast, you can do that by giving us a 5-star review on iTunes. I'm not normally a person who asks for things like that, but I love doing this podcast and it seems to be the thing you have to do. So thank you for listening to that bit, and thanks so much to everyone who's answered the call and reviewed us already.